On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
What did you think when you first heard Donald Trump's proposal to put a temporary ban on all Muslims coming into the United States?
Well, obviously, that's antithetical to our approach. But what was worse was this, we'll have them all register. That's reminiscent of Nazi Germany. I mean, that's monstrous, as I said at the time.
That's Charles Koch in a recent interview on ABC's This Week. He and his brother David have been big contributors to Republican presidential candidates and causes. The one candidate they've said they will not get behind is Donald Trump. More on what the Koch brothers are doing with their money in a moment. But first, there are plenty of other big spenders ready to drop some dollars on Donald Trump. He's kicking off his fundraising efforts here in Los Angeles tonight. The event is being hosted at the mansion of real estate billionaire Tom Barrack. And if you want to attend, the cheapest ticket will cost you $25,000. Insiders involved in the event have said there will be some entertainment bigwigs there, but many are reluctant to openly state their support of Trump in liberal Hollywood. Andy Kroll is a writer with the California Sunday Magazine who covers American politics and Hollywood. Welcome to the program, Andy.
Great to be here.
Well, what do we know about the host of the fundraiser tonight, Tom Barrack?
He and Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican Party's presidential nominee, go back more than three decades. Tom Barrack and Donald Trump did a deal, one of the great Donald Trump deals in Trump's telling, many years ago, the sale of the Great Plaza Hotel in Manhattan. Donald Trump had always coveted this building. He said it was a beautiful painting that he saw outside of his office window every day. And it was with Tom Barrack that he negotiated the deal to buy the plaza from Tom Barrack's boss at the time. And the two have remained friends ever since. When Donald Trump got into the presidential fray, Tom Barrack has been a very vocal and public supporter of his. He called Donald Trump one of the kindest and most humble friends I've had earlier this year. So this guy is all in for Donald Trump.
Humble. I think Trump calls himself humble. But so what does he do here in Los Angeles, Tom Barrack?
He's an investor, and he most recently was the chairman and sort of the pseudo CEO of Miramax, a studio that has won many Oscars over the years, successful, formerly run by the Weinstein brothers, and has produced movies like Pulp Fiction and Shakespeare in Love. His investment firm Colony Capital recently sold Miramax, but for a time he was one of the big studio bigwigs in show business in Southern California.
So who else is showing up tonight?
That's a great question that we don't have the answer to, because the attendee lists for any fundraiser of this size and magnitude, whether it would be for Secretary Clinton or for Donald Trump or any other candidate, are very closely held. And usually information comes out, if we get any at all, afterward. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, it's supposed to be, more than 100 people attending, paying at least $25,000 a pop. And if they want to give the most, if they want to max out in the parlance, it's almost $450,000, money that would go to Donald Trump's campaign, but also to Republican Party, state Republican parties and the National Party around the country. And it'll be very interesting if we find out after this evening is over what types of folks and how many of the industry bigwigs will get behind Donald Trump, because many of them were fractured during the Republican primary supporting a number of various candidates.
So of all the places to start his fundraising, why Los Angeles?
Donald Trump is, a media figure. He is an entertainment figure, probably best known in many parts of the country or the world for being a reality television show host and star. His connections to Hollywood, to the entertainment business, run incredibly deep. Tom Barrack being a great example of that. But just through the television networks and through his own many business ventures, in addition to his real estate work, you know, he's more than a known quantity in Los Angeles. And while he has mostly funded his own presidential campaign, he has garnered a pretty good amount of support from Southern California in various forms. There's a TV and movie producer, John Powers Middleton. He was a producer on Lego's movie, Bates Motel, a television show, mm-hmm. who gave six figures to a super PAC supporting Donald Trump during the primary. So he does have a decent base of support here, and he's, you know, an incredibly known person who has spent a tremendous amount of time in Los Angeles over the years.
So was he more liked before he became a presidential candidate here?
Yes.
Openly?
Yeah, that's the sense that I'd gotten. I mean, he's always been a bombastic character, you know, larger than life, businessman. But, you know, the presidential campaign has been a time when he's, you know, obviously come out on all these sorts of issues, immigration, gender, marriage equality, you know, the whole range of issues that you have to tackle as a presidential candidate. And obviously that has polarized and frankly, you know, offended a great deal of people, especially folks that I've talked to who are active in politics on both sides or on all ends of the political spectrum in Hollywood and Southern California. Donald Trump as a presidential candidate, you know, has taken Donald Trump as a businessman in some ways and only, you know, magnified it or blown it up to a whole new level. And he's become, you know, a lightning rod in Southern California, especially in Los Angeles and Hollywood, for people who want to support him and people who don't want to support him. It's a very controversial issue, divides friends, you know, divides front offices. And so, you know, he has only become more divisive.
Mm-hmm. You recently wrote about this group called Friends of Abe, and this is a group of conservatives in Hollywood. They don't fundraise necessarily, but you wrote that they are pretty influential. Who are they and how are they influential?
They are everyone representing every walk of life and, you know, level of fame or not in the movie, television, music industry. It's everyone from A-listers like Clint Eastwood or Gary Sinise, or John Voight, also someone who endorsed Donald Trump, all the way to the lowliest production assistant, a gaffer, electrician, a gopher on a studio lot. There are about 2,500 people, roughly, in this group, Friends of Abe. And it exists really, they call it a fellowship. It exists really for people who are like-minded, who are conservative, Republican, in some cases libertarian, to get together and talk about politics and talk about the issues of the day in an industry and in a town where they feel is hostile to their views, you know, some rightly, some wrongly. The group, you know, represents basically a cross-section of the Republican Party. You would find every supporters of every candidate in this wild Republican primary in the group. You know, what I heard from Friends of Abe members, but who, by the way, were treated to an appearance by Donald Trump. One of the earliest events he did last summer was he came to Los Angeles, did a few events, and then spoke at a Friends of Abe event in Brentwood. You know, what I heard from those folks is that Donald Trump, you know, has been dividing even Hollywood's own, you know, conservative club. You know, he's been incredibly controversial. People fighting over whether he's good for the party, whether he's bad, whether he can beat Hillary Clinton, whether he can't. And frankly, you know, some friendships have been frayed, and relationships have been put under great stress over the issue of what do we do about Donald Trump within this group, Friends of Abe. And that, you know, the last that I spoke to these folks, which was pretty recently, they were still figuring out, you know, what do we do now, and how do we move forward in a, you know, in a time when Donald Trump is now the flag bearer for our political party, the Republican Party.
Andy, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Andy Kroll. He's a writer with the California Sunday Magazine. Well, we'd like to hear from you. Are you feeling the same tensions politically with your friends and loved ones? Or are you keeping your political opinions to yourself this election year, scared of getting shouted down? by fans of an opposing candidate. Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the biggest names in conservative political donations are sitting out the presidential race. So where are the Koch brothers spending their fortune this election year? We'll find out with investigative reporter Jane Mayer next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 4 years ago, billionaires Charles and David Koch raised $400 million in a losing campaign against the re-election of President Obama. This year, they wanted to raise a war chest of nearly $900 million to make sure a conservative candidate wins in November. And that's more than the Republican Party itself is likely to raise. But it seems the brothers Koch have been thwarted yet again, this time by the one Republican candidate they say they will not support, and that's Donald Trump. As a result, the Kochs reportedly have changed their minds about spending any money on the presidential election. Instead, they'll focus on local elections and on continuing to support a network of conservative organizations they helped build over four decades, organizations that have successfully helped usher in a conservative era across the country. Jane Mayer wrote about the Koch network for her book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, and she's here now. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Well, the Kochs aren't exactly transparent. They don't give a lot of interviews. But do you have any idea why they have decided not to support Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, he really doesn't reflect their worldview. He's not in favor of cutting the federal government in a big way. And they are staunch libertarians who are really radical when it comes to their notion of what the government should do. They think the government should do pretty much nothing but protect private property. So that's Trump is just not their kind of Republican. He's even talking about trying to preserve Social Security, which they have been pushing to privatize for years. So he flies in the face of many of the things they believe in.
Did they support Ted Cruz?
They have a sort of a secret session where they get all the donors in their group together twice a year, and they have invited virtually every major Republican presidential candidate but Trump to it. So they could live with pretty much any of the others. It's only Trump who has really sort of thumbed his nose at them, calling the other candidates puppets for taking their money, and who they have really spoken loudly about disagreeing with.
So, as I said, it's been reported that they will focus on local and state races instead, maybe judicial races. Do you know more about
that? Well, not just judicial races, but certainly those. I mean, in many ways, I think people are underestimating the power and the influence of the Kochs and their money this year, just because they're only, everybody, we're all fixated on the presidential election. It's so interesting and unpredictable and wild. But it's never really been the biggest part of the Koch spending in the past or, in recent years. They've poured money into state races, into trying to turn the Senate into a Republican Senate, getting a majority, and into the House of Representatives to try to get a Republican majority. They've been very successful in all those races, and even more so in governorships and in state legislatures across the country. These are kind of unglamorous or less glamorous races, so the press doesn't pay as much attention to them, but it's had a tremendous effect nationwide, where the country, if you take a look at it, is turning more and more red at the state political level, and a lot of that is in part thanks to the kind of money that the Kochs have been pouring into it.
Although it has been speculated that the Senate could go back to being democratically controlled.
It's possible. I mean, I think what the Kochs are going to try to do, from the reporting I've been doing on them, is they're going to try very hard to hold on to Congress and keep it in Republican hands. So they have already started spending. And they've reserved airtime for television advertisements in a number of Senate races. I think in total, I counted, they've got 8 Senate races that they're actively participating in, 32 House races, and 5 gubernatorial races. And they've got a tremendous network of people that they have now created. They've got over 1,000 people who are on their payroll who are doing nothing but politics. And they operate in 35 states across the country. And that apparently is a growth of something like by 50% over just last year. So while everybody's taking a look only at the presidential race, there's actually a lot going on beneath the surface, which is usually true of the Kochs.
Is there anyone attempting to do that on the other side?
I think we will see super PACs certainly playing on all sides, and there will be super PAC money, and there is super PAC money going into backing Hillary Clinton at the presidential level. But there's really nobody who is operating at the state legislative level the way that the Koch network does. And it's not, I mean, and the other thing to say that's really important to understand is they have long not just supported candidates. They're really not just about elections. They have created an array of advocacy groups that push their point of view and get voters out to sort of militate for their point of view. So it's this tremendous network, really. You've got Americans for Prosperity. You've got the Libre Initiative, which is a Hispanic group's Generation Opportunity, which is pushing to try to get kids involved behind their point of view, behind sort of this libertarian worldview. And just so many, 60 Plus Association, which is for retirees, and Concerned Women for America, which is a kind of a conservative women's group. And then they work with many pre-existing groups. They've worked with the National Rifle Association and with the Right to Work Foundation, pouring money into all these groups, which in turn reach out to American citizens and get them riled up on issues and get them to vote their way.
Well, what might be ironic, I guess, maybe for them, is that if all these people get riled up and go to the voting booth and vote for these down-ticket candidates who they support, they might also be pulling the lever for Donald Trump.
That's true. And I think it will probably, so that in that way, I think what we're going to see is that even, in a secondhand way, the Kochs are going to wind up aiding the efforts of Donald Trump. And because, if they increase turnout and do all the kind of research into issues to try to see what works, which they do a lot of very expensive kind of analysis and focus group testing, all of that helps the top of the ticket as well as the bottom of the ticket.
So they were instrumental in the rise of the Tea Party.
They were.
And mm-hmm. With their money and their influence. And I wonder also, an irony here, that the Tea Party, they engaged in a lot of stymieing of legislation, and they were behind the government shutdown. Ted Cruz, a prime example of that. And that is being reported as one reason why there's so much voter anger this year and so much support for outsiders like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Also, this feeling that Congress is broken, that it can't get anything done. So is that also something that the Kochs are thinking of, that perhaps the support of the Tea Party may be boomeranged a little bit?
The Kochs actually backed the government shutdown. And when John Boehner, who was then the Speaker of the House, was trying to avert it, what was interesting was that he flew to New York and begged David Koch, in David Koch's office, to, as someone put it, call off the dogs. He wanted to try to get the Kochs to back off the Tea Party members in the House and make them behave and not shut down the government. So the Kochs have been on the side of the shutdown, and I've never heard them say that they regret it in any way. What they're saying actually right now is that they regret that they didn't have more influence. They feel that the government hasn't changed enough. And so they are pushing this sort of idea that the status quo, it holds, and that if you're going to change the country, you really need to go back to basics and change how people think about politics. And so they're pouring money into think tanks and into universities and into advocacy groups to really kind of change the way Americans think.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jane Mayer, investigative reporter at The New Yorker, author of the book Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. I wonder if, looking at the campaign and the election this year, and you see Bernie Sanders' success in terms of fundraising, of whether or not that has dampened the power of groups like the Kochs and their organizations in terms of influencing elections.
Well, we will see. I mean, I think what we are seeing, and it's really interesting, is a kind of a national backlash and an outpouring of anger at this idea that a handful of billionaires could try to influence the outcome of the election for the rest of the country. I think there's a really angry feeling across the land about big money and vested interests taking over the government. And I think that it certainly helped Bernie Sanders' campaign. And I think in many ways it's helped Trump's campaign. I mean, he's been casting himself as anti-establishment and saying he is just going to run on his own money and not take other people's. But we're beginning to see that he's changing that tune. He said that during the primaries, but now he's saying, oh, for the general election, he will take money. And interestingly, a number of the people who are coming around to backing him are people who were stalwarts in the Kochs network. So even while the Koch brothers themselves may be sitting on the sidelines, you've got a number of people like Sheldon Adelson, who the casino magnate, who has said he would spend as much as $100 million to help Trump get elected. And there are several others from that group. Diane Hendricks, who's got a huge home building company based in Wisconsin, ABC Supply, has said that she now will get behind Trump. And Stanley Hubbard, who's always been a big member of the Koch group, who's a broadcaster, he's got media properties, is also getting behind Trump. So you're beginning to see a migration of some of the same money that made the Koch network what it was, migrating now behind Trump.
So do you think the Kochs might change their minds and actually support him?
You know, I just don't know. I mean, I think that they would only do so if Trump sang their song. If he starts saying that he's going to not raise taxes on the rich and he will cut regulations, and particularly environmental regulations, you know, I suppose that if he starts coming their way, maybe they'll start coming his. We'll have to wait and watch.
In your book, you report about some of the hardball tactics the Kochs have employed against their perceived enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Including setting private investigators on people to dig up dirt. In fact, that happened to you.
Yeah.
Once you started reporting on them and you faced some of those reprisals. So what happened? How did that end up?
So the Kochs hired a private eye who I was eventually able to figure out who it was. It was the former commissioner of police in New York City, Howard Safer. And he's become a private eye along with his family. He's got a son and a daughter who work with him who are spent a good deal of time trying to dig up dirt on me on behalf of the Kochs so that they could hope to kind of discredit me as a reporter. Luckily, I'm glad to say it boomeranged. I was able to sort of expose it in time and show that what they were trying to do was really underhanded. And they were going to try to plant some negative stories in the press, and the press wouldn't run them because the stories weren't correct. But boy, it was ugly, and it really lets you see how ruthless people with a tremendous amount of money and power in the country can be for the press. It's hard to cover them. You feel that, you know, you feel their power when you go up against them.
Wow. So do you ever think twice when you're asked to do interviews like this? Do you ever think maybe I shouldn't?
Well, I'm careful about trying not to say anything that will get me sued because I really don't want to spend the rest of my life in court with these people. But other than that, you know, this is my job.
Yeah.
You cannot cover politics without covering money, and you can't cover money in politics without covering the Kochs.
Jane Mayer, investigative reporter at The New Yorker. Her book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Jane, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Coming Coming up on the show, why Los Angeles public schools are paying out hundreds of millions of dollars to child sex abuse victims.
LAUSD over the last 20 years is much like Mahoney and the Archdiocese. We are naming five former superintendents of the Los Angeles Unified School District as defendants in this case.
What's the cost of these lawsuits and why are there so many? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Los Angeles Unified School District has paid out more than $300 million to sexual abuse victims in just the last 4 years. These payouts aren't for crimes committed by the teachers. They're for LAUSD failing to protect the students, either missing warning signs or dismissing complaints. Howard Bloom is reporting on this for the LA Times, where he covers education. Hi, Howard.
Hey.
So just this month, the school district settled two lawsuits involving some 30 students, and these two teachers are now in prison serving long sentences. What was the district, LAUSD, accused of?
Well, the district was accused of missing warning signs that, had they heeded them, would have been able to prevent a lot of this abuse to students. Because as you alluded to in your introduction, it isn't the abuse itself that makes a public agency like LA Unified liable. It's what they could have done to notice it and prevent it. And then once the district is liable, then the extent of the abuse can become a factor in how large that liability is. So that's the basic argument here. And the district feared that it did have liability. A couple of these cases went to trial, and the district lost. And at that point, it figured it better settle the rest of them.
So what were some of these warning signs?
Well, in some cases, the warning signs are very blatant, like in the case of Robert Pimentel. This is an elementary teacher. He apparently was pretty notorious for slapping young girls on the buttocks and doing things that were completely inappropriate. And his explanation in one interview was that he was on medication and therefore his sexual impulses were out of whack. At another point, the principal was aware that he was being subpoenaed for possibly abusing a child relative of his. And those kind of incidents you think would have been enough to at least prompt an inquiry. But in less subtle cases, I mean in less overt cases, I should say, it's things like if you see a teacher who constantly has the door closed, students in there with the door closed, and posters covering the windows, somebody who's giving rides to kids, gives long, lingering hugs to teenagers. I mean, it's a combination of things. Sometimes it's just the creep factor that something isn't right that people have to pay attention to. Now, the shame of it is, of course, that the 99% of 99-plus, perhaps, percent of able educators are now wondering whether they can give a hug to a child who needs a hug because of the molesters out there. But you do have to be aware of these warning signs. That's just the world we live in, and the abusers go to where the kids are.
But it's not just the warning signs. It's actual outright complaints that teachers and administrators ignored.
That's right, but the warning signs are enough because the warning signs are well established, and the attorneys in court have done really well with just establishing that the warning signs existed and in creating this liability for the district. I mean, you're rarely going to catch the teacher doing something very overt with the student. But yes, in some cases there have been overt complaints that the district throughout its history has either ignored or overlooked or just mishandled. And the district says it has truly changed its ways, but that these cases take a long time to play out and go through the pipeline. So they are settling a case last week, but that this does not mean that the abuse happened last week.
Right. So did all this change after this notorious Miramonte case involving Mark Burnt and some 80 kids involved?
Well, yes, there were a lot of changes after that case, but it's not the first time that LA Unified has, quote-unquote, reformed its system. There was an assistant principal, Stephen Thomas Rooney, who was uncovered doing things in 2007, and there was a wave of reforms then that apparently did not do enough to solve the problem. LA Unified thinks it's on top of the matter now, but time will tell.
Yeah, because as you write, there are still more surfacing. There's this football coach named, his name is Jaime Jimenez.
Yeah, Jaime Jimenez. And in that case, he was a walk-on football coach. He might have received some money, you know, as a part-time person, kind of doing a full-time job, semi-paid, semi-volunteer. And the district would probably argue in court that it can't be expected to supervise a community member who helps out, but the plaintiffs will argue, well, he was an ex officio staff member, and therefore he was within the orbit of LA Unified. And that was, if the testimony bears out, that was a pretty outrageous case of molestation.
So they say that they have mended their ways. The district has it instilled a whole new set of guidelines and procedures for school administrators to follow? Is there training? What is it?
Well, I mean, I thought their policies were pretty good after they reformed them in 2007, but they're doing more now. They have training. Even before these new policies, teachers had to take a refresher course every year in how to recognize abuse, and they were reminded that they were mandated to report it. They're also doing more training for parents now and updated the training for administrators because, you know, parents, of course, are key players in this as well. And a lot of what they've done is better record keeping. The record keeping was very inconsistent. Some records were not kept. Some were at a school. Some were in the central office. Now they try to keep documentation literally forever. They have it centralized, and they keep a portfolio on every teacher, in essence. And some teachers feel like Big Brother has invaded their classroom. But again, maybe that's just the way things have to be to keep students safe.
So, as you say, they're now keeping records forever. Are they now going back into their records to find out if there are any more possible victims or any teachers who...
They did that. They did that in the wake of the arrest of Mark Burnt at Miramonte. There was a many months long process. They also resubmitted to the State Commission on Teacher Credentialing all the reports, many of which they had already submitted, but just on the odd chance that they had overlooked submitting something, they improved the communications with the police department. They also set up a special investigations team that has former FBI agents, et cetera, that at a cost of several million dollars a year that is solely focused on rooting out things in LA Unified. And, of course, some teachers have felt that they have overcorrected, including defenders of Rafe Esquith, an award-winning teacher who was fired for doing things that were considered abusive, although may have stopped short of molestation. At any rate, I mean, that's a very controversial case.
Yeah.
But whenever you have these fixes, there's always the danger of overreach as well.
So we called up an education reporter at WNYC in New York to see how New York public schools compare. And she said there really aren't that many of these settlements there for sex abuse or more complaints about bullying and not protecting students from bullying.
Well, I mean, I spoke to advocates in the field. One thing I asked them, are these more prevalent in states with strong unions, because unions have protections for teachers in the books? And they said, well, actually, no, that there are many, many of these cases in Texas, for example, where unions are pretty weak. And what they said, what they tell me is that invariably districts are very good at keeping these cases secrets, and that routinely they ask for confidentiality agreements when they make a settlement, and that unless you specifically and repeatedly and very doggedly seek out all settlements related to this, there could be all sorts of settlements that you don't know about. And their view is that LA Unified is not any worse than any place else. Again, I don't know, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on New York. I'm just saying what the advocates tell me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Howard Bloom covers education for the LA Times. Thanks.
Happy to do it.
Well, for a long time, city leaders have been trying to turn downtown's Grand Avenue into a vibrant urban center. But the centerpiece of that vision has gone unrealized, a pair of towers designed by Frank Gehry across from the Walt Disney Concert Hall. Yesterday, the city took a step toward finally building them. A city council committee voted to give a private developer nearly $200 million over 25 years to get the project done. That does not mean a groundbreaking is coming anytime soon, though. John Rigardi is executive editor of the Downtown News. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, for some context, so this Grand Avenue project has been in the works for a long, long time, and it was supposed to turn Grand Avenue into really a hive of activity. And so what was the overall vision? How far back does it go? And who's behind it?
Well, it goes back a long ways, literally almost 15 years. You know, what we're talking about just, you know, is, you know, a series of parcels along Grand Avenue, some of which are owned by the city, some of which are owned by the county. Shortly after the turn of the millennium, the city and county started working on plans to develop them, get some use up there, activate the street, as many people had already had long wanted. So they created this international competition. In 2004, a contract was awarded to related companies to develop these sites. And in 2006, related companies, this big mammoth New York developer, unveiled the first plans for these two towers with Frank Gehry. People were really excited. They started talking about hotels, a plan that was nearly $2 billion. It was moving forward. And then, boom, the recession hit like so many other projects. The project stalled when lending markets froze, and it stopped moving forward. It was, you know, fairly dead for a while. You know, came back several years ago, originally with a different architect, and then Frank Gehry was brought back into it. So here you are, only about 15 years later, and they're hoping to get toward a groundbreaking.
Okay, so then you might look at $200 million in taxpayer money and say, what? Why is that going to a private developer?
You know, it's a really interesting question. There's a couple, there's a couple reasons. One, with hotel projects, particularly in downtown over the last year, there has been a big move, and some people support it and others are against it, but it has definitely been a move where the hotel developers get these subsidies. Essentially, what they're able to do is keep what they call the transit occupancy tax, keep all or a portion of that, and that's the tax that travelers, you know, would normally pay on hotel rooms. It's about 14%, I think, and, you know, it's been argued that this is what helps these projects pencil out. But you know, I think one of the bigger questions that's tied with it is people want to say, okay, well, you know, what does, you know, related, what does the city get out of this? One thing that was super interesting about this project is that when the agreement was originally announced, former county supervisor Gloria Molina, she negotiated a key deal point, and that was that related had to pay $50 million up front for public benefits. Normally, this money happens later after a project moves forward or opens. But in this case, Related wrote a $50 million check, and that $50 million was what paid for Grand Park, the beautiful 12-acre park that now connects City Hall and the Music Center. So, that was one of the big elements that has really helped bring downtown forward, along with a lot of other projects. And it's an aspect that does often get overlooked. So, would Related get to benefit from a subsidy? Absolutely. But, it's also fair to point out that, they did do something that was not commonly done in development, and that's benefited a lot of people.
So the Broad Museum, is that part of this overall plan?
Well, it's another great question. There's so many weird twists and machinations with this. Originally, when Related got the contract, it was for a series of whole different, I think four different parcels, and they all had funny little names, Parcel M, Parcel Q. When the project slowed down during the recession, that's also around the same time that Eli Broad, as we know, started saying, I want to build this giant museum, and he's always been a big supporter of Grand Avenue, and he wanted to do it on Grand Avenue. There were, with the project stalled, there were a series of negotiations. Some might call it arm twisting, whatever phrase you want to use. Eventually, one of the parcels was turned from Related's control over to Eli's control, and that is where the museum is. That's $140 million. It's really done a lot to activate the street. I was actually walking by there yesterday morning at 11 o'clock in the morning. There was a line around the block. So that's how this all fits in. It just took away one of the parcels, but it's still another big parcel that we're talking about here. One of those really which may be the ugliest parking structure in the city. It's what they call the Tinker Toy Lot across from Disney Hall.
Right, right. Well, yeah, there's a lot of activity around the Broad Museum, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of street life on Grand Avenue. People aren't really just strolling up and down the avenue and hanging out. They're either going to the Broad or the Disney Concert Hall, and then they're leaving.
Yeah, exactly, and that is one of the problems. And what's amazing is there are tens of thousands of people there, but they're all working in these big tall office towers, and office towers both on the east and west sides of Grand Avenue have these sort of food courts and eating sections that are sort of removed off the street. So again, you're not getting a lot of activity. That's one of the hopes that with the Grand Avenue project that that it will have, along with these two towers, that it will have this retail / restaurant component that opens up to the street and will help activate the area and get people not only over to the office buildings and to the Broad, but also to Disney Hall, to the Museum of Contemporary Art, which is right there, to the Colburn School.
Mm, right. So when do you think this will actually happen?
Well, that is the $800 million question. By virtue of the approval which you mentioned before, that indicates that the project does seem to be moving forward. When I spoke with a project representative the other week, they said that the plan remains to have a groundbreaking by the end of November in 2017. So could it happen? Sure. But again, we're talking about something that's well over a year away. There's a lot of people who are starting to say, maybe we're nearing the end of a development cycle. Could the economy turn? So there's a lot of questions here. Will this happen? I'd say 100% definitely, maybe, possibly it could.
Okay. I'm glad for that final statement. Well, at least we got a park out of it, so that's good.
And a lovely park it is.
Yeah. John Regardi, executive editor of the Downtown News. Thanks.
Thanks, Madeline.
And coming up on this program, the drought is forcing us to think of new ways to get water from the Colorado River. Is it time to mothball those big hydroelectric dams? That story is next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Glen Canyon Dam is an enormous structure located near the Utah-Arizona border, about 20 miles north of the Grand Canyon. It was built to harness and store Colorado River water for surrounding states and to generate clean energy to power the region. It stands as a symbol of 20th century ingenuity, a feat of engineering that allowed towns to thrive in a desert. But in the 21st century, we're in a drought, and water levels are at historic lows, not just at Lake Powell, which is behind Glen Canyon Dam, but Hoover Dam's Lake Mead as well, which supplies water to California. There's now an effort underfoot to combine the two dams into one, which could save a lot of water, enough for the yearly needs of the entire city of Los Angeles. Joining me now is Abram Lustgarten. He's a senior reporter at ProPublica, and his piece is called Drought Be Damned. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first talk about Lake Mead, because that's at an all-time low. And what does that mean for California?
It's extremely important to California. Lake Mead is the reservoir that holds California's supply from the Colorado River, as well as the other southern river basin states, Arizona and Nevada. California is the largest user of water on the Colorado River, depends on it for about 50 to 60% of its metropolitan supplies in the Los Angeles to San Diego metro area. And Lake Mead is the reserve for that water.
And though California, Southern California, has the most senior water rights, though, to the Colorado River?
It does, thanks to agreements that go back, close to 100 years. California is virtually guaranteed, at least legally, the right to take its water, even as Arizona and Nevada face cutbacks. There's some question of whether that would actually hold up, whether that sort of confrontational approach would last. But yes, on paper, California can take its water almost no matter what until the river dries up.
Wow. The entire river dries up.
Yeah, virtually.
And seven states share this river before it reaches Mexico.
Yeah, that's right. It's divided into the lower and the upper half. So the upper states are, New Mexico New Mexico and Wyoming and Colorado and Utah. And part of the problem is that thanks to a 1922 agreement that basically divided the river in half, but overestimated the amount of water flowing in it, the southern states, led by California, essentially take a very disproportionate amount of water out of the river each year, not really leaving enough in it for those northern states, let alone Nevada and Arizona, to take their share.
Okay, so that's Lake Mead. Let's talk about the Glen Canyon Dam, and that is the second largest dam in the country. Why was that built so close, relatively speaking, to the Hoover Dam?
So Glen Canyon Dam was basically built to give those northern states a gateway, something to hold their water in before they delivered it down to essentially California. The northern states in the 1950s and 40s were worried that California was growing too fast. They had a legal obligation to send a quota of water downstream, but they wanted to make sure that they had a mechanism to not send more than that quota. Otherwise, they feared they'd be taken advantage of by California. So Glen Canyon Dam was built for several reasons, but largely to create an impoundment that would give those northern states a place to store their water separate from Lake Mead, which is where the southern states store their water.
And the problem there is that the water there is disappearing?
Well, the water is disappearing in both reservoirs for the same reasons, because the river is overallocated. It's flowed at far less than normal flows for the last 16 years straight, and yet all of the states continue to take their full allotment out of the river. So both reservoirs, Mead and Powell, were our savings banks, essentially, and we've been drawing them down for almost two decades. And part of the reason that there's now a discussion about, whether these reservoirs should be combined is because they basically serve a duplicate function. They're just 300 miles apart on the river. One is used by half the states, the other by the other half, but both reservoirs are only half full. So there's a lot of questions coming up now about whether it might be more efficient to just have one single full reservoir as opposed to two half-empty ones.
Why would that be an advantage? It's still the same amount of water.
Well, there's two reasons. One is that an enormous amount of water evaporates off the surface of these reservoirs built in arid environments, and in Lake Powell also leaks out the bottom. So there's a great amount of water lost, and if you only had one reservoir, you would have significantly less surface area and less evaporation. And that sounds like kind of a geeky thing, but it adds up to an enormous amount of water, and enough water that, as you said, could supply about 9 million people each year. The second reason is that these hydroelectric generators that are built at both facilities, at both the Hoover Dam and at Glen Canyon, their function is reflective both of how much water flows through them, but also of how deep the water is behind the dam. And so as both of these reservoirs get shallower and shallower, there's less force behind the generators, and neither one of them are generating nearly as efficiently as they would if, say, there were one full reservoir.
So would they be able to generate enough power for all of the states as one?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question. That there's not necessarily clear answers. I, for my reporting, relied on some research that was done for the Glen Canyon Institute, which obviously has, a conservation bias towards getting rid of Lake Powell. But they did a pretty thorough analysis of that question, and there's no replacing Glen Canyon Dam. If both dams were operating at full capacity, they would generate an enormous amount of power. You can't get away from that. But since the reservoir is declining on its own, they tried to look at the efficiency savings of using only Lake Mead. They found that you'd have, a large amount of loss from Lake Powell, but that the added efficiency at Lake Mead would chip away at that loss and at least make up for some of it. So you end up, negative of where we are now or where we should be, but not quite at zero in terms of power generation.
And what would that do to the environment if you got rid of Lake Powell?
Well, certainly hydropower is a clean, good source of energy. So in terms of the power question itself, it's a difficult decision to get rid of hydroelectric power right now. That's one factor to be considered for sure. But there are other positive aspects of getting rid of Lake Powell, or at least allowing the lake to drain. There's a lot of people that would like to see the canyon, Glen Canyon, that was flooded, restored, an enormously beautiful piece of the Western landscape, and a place that could be restored, could potentially be from in the views of those who saw it before it was flooded, national park quality territory. And there's also the supposed benefits to endangered species, four endangered fish species in the Grand Canyon that would come from the normalized flows of a natural river going through the Grand Canyon again. Right now, Glen Canyon Dam basically blocks the water before it ever gets to the Grand Canyon.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Abram Lustgarten, senior reporter at ProPublica, where you can read his piece, Drought Be Damned. Julie Myers joins us at the tail end of the show. Hello.
That's right. I've had all these comments dammed up inside of me, and we're releasing
Let it
them
flow.
All.
Release.
So we talked about people who are keeping quiet this campaign season. They have a candidate they like, but they're keeping it to themselves. They don't want to get in fights. They don't want to be embarrassed in front of some of their other friends. And so we asked our listeners whether or not they were keeping quiet. And if they are keeping quiet, then they're keeping real quiet because they didn't
respond.
The people who are keeping quiet didn't respond, but there's a few people who wanted to say, if you are closeted about the support of a candidate, that actually says something about the candidate, and perhaps you should take a really hard look on who you're supporting. And Andrew Amick says that, I'm not surprised that there's people who are closeted about certain candidates. I would be too, but perhaps they should take a hard look at why they're closeted.
Okay, we'd love to hear from you, you closeted people out there. You can tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Thanks, Julie Myers, and thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.